What other political leaders in Latin America today do you feel fulfill the Fair Play for Cuba Committee's requirements for a democratic political leader?
Well, you know, there's a funny story about Latin America. It goes something like this: coffee, bananas, sugar, and a few other products. In other words, that refers to the so-called banana countries, countries which like Cuba, up to this time, had a one-crop agriculture, a one-crop economy. And where did those crops go? They went to the United States. Now, the attitude of those countries who are controlled by the United States, whose economy depends almost 100% upon how much money the United States pours into them, those countries cannot be expected to give an independent viewpoint on Cuba or Castro. The few countries which abstained at certain international inter-American meetings during the last year are those countries which are big enough to support themselves, those countries being only Brazil, Argentina, and perhaps in some cases the Democratic Republic of Costa Rica, which is, by the way, the only democratic republic in all of Central America.
What is your definition of democracy?
The definition of democracy. That's a very good one. That's a very controversial viewpoint. You know, it used to be very clear, but now it's not. You know, when our forefathers drew up the Constitution, they considered that democracy was creating an atmosphere of freedom, of discussion, of argument, of finding the truth. The rights of, well, the classic right of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In Latin America, they have none of those rights, none of them at all. And that is my definition of democracy, the right to be in a minority and not to be suppressed, the right to see for yourself, without government restrictions, such countries as Cuba, and we are, by the way, restricted from going to Cuba.
Mr. Oswald, when was the last time you were in Latin America?
I've been only to Mexico in my life, sir. I'm not fully acquainted with Latin America personally, but then I'm not the president of this organization either. I'm merely a volunteer, a secretary of this local chapter. I do not claim to be an expert on Latin America, but then very few people do. Certainly, it is obvious to me, having been educated here in New Orleans, and having been instilled with the ideas of democracy and objectiveness, that Cuba and the right of the Cubans to self-determination is more or less self-evident. And one does not have to travel through Central and South America. One does not have to see the poverty in Chile or Peru or the suppression of democratic liberties by the Samoa brothers in Nicaragua in order to draw one's conclusion about Cuba.
Does the Fair Play for Cuba Committee have any opinion about the suppression of democratic liberties in Hungary in 1956 or the poverty in any of the Eastern Bloc countries today?
Officially, no, but of course we have our own opinions about such situation. We consider that Russian imperialism is a very bad thing. It was a bad thing in Hungary. We certainly do not support dictatorship or the suppression of any peoples anywhere. But as I say, and as I must stress, we are preoccupied only with the problem of Cuba officially.
Mr. Oswald, you have the title of secretary of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. However, you've just said that you've never been to Latin America except for a few ventures into Mexico. In that case, just exactly how do you get your information concerning Latin American affairs or Latin American conditions?
Well, as I say, we are preoccupied with the problem of Cuba. There are correspondents, people who correspond with the headquarters in New York from Cuba, directly from Cuba. That is where they get their information about Cuba. Now, in regards to Latin and Central America, you do not have to be you do not have to have your own correspondent there. The AP and the UP cover it very well, and they certainly give a very clear picture of the situation in certain countries, Nicaragua and so forth, as I mentioned, which have very undemocratic regimes, dictatorships. And as I say, these things are well known by everyone, and they accepted it as truth. For instance, you will not be able to find any official or any person who knows about Latin America who will say that Nicaragua does not have a dictatorship.
Very interesting that you should mention dictatorships in Nicaragua. because we naturally from reading the press have heard about these dictatorships for many, many years. But it's curious to me as to why no Nicaraguans fled to the United States last year, whereas we had possibly 50 to 60,000 Cubans fleeing from Cuba to the United States. Yes. What is the Fair Play for Cuba Committee's official reply to this?
Well, a good question. Nicaraguan situation is one considerably different from Castro's Cuba. People are not inclined to flee their countries unless some new system, some new factor enters into their lives. I must say that very surely into the Nicaragua, no new factors have entered for about 300 years. In fact, the people live exactly how as they have always lived in Nicaragua. I'm referring to the overwhelming majority of people in Nicaragua, which is a feudal dictatorship with 90% of the people engaged in agriculture. These peasants are uneducated. They have one of the lowest living standards in all of the Western Hemisphere. And so because of the fact that no new factor has entered into their lives, because of the fact that no liberating factor has entered into their lives, they remain in Nicaragua. Now, the people who have fled Cuba, that is an interesting situation. Needless to say, there are classes of criminals. There are classes of people who are wanted in Cuba for crimes against humanity. And most of those people are the same people who in New Orleans have set themselves up in stores with blood money and who engage in day-to-day trade with New Orleanians. Those are the people who would certainly not want to go back to Cuba and who would certainly want to flee Cuba. There are other classes. There are peasants who do not like the collectivization in Cuban agriculture. There are others who, for one reason or another, more or less legitimate reasons, reasons of opinion, have fled Cuba. Most of these people flee by legal means. They are allowed to leave after requesting the Cuban government for exit visas. Some of these people, for some reasons or another, do not like to apply for these visas, or they feel that they cannot get them. They flee. They flee Cuba in boats. They flee any way they can go. And I think that the opinion and the attitude of the Cuban government to this is good riddance.
Mr. Oswald, that's very interesting. Because as a reporter in this field for some time, I've been interviewing refugees for now about 3 years. And I'd say that the last Batista man officially that I talked to left Cuba about 2.5 years ago. The rest of them that I've talked to have been taxicab drivers, day laborers, cane cutters, and that sort of thing. I thought this revolution was supposed to benefit these people. What is the Fair Play for Cuba's position on this?
Well, as I say, there are different classes. A minority of class of these people are, as I say, people who were Batista criminals and so forth. It may not be true that the people fleeing nowadays are completely cleansed of Batista elements. Certainly some of these Batistaites have been hiding or have been engaging in counter-revolutionary activities ever since the Bay of Pigs invasion and even before that, just after the revolution. In other words, they have remained on the ground. Undoubtedly, the overwhelming majority of people during the last year, for instance, who have fled Cuba have been non-Batistaites, rather peasants class. You say the revolution is supposed to benefit these people. You know, it's very funny about revolutions. Revolutions require work. Revolutions require sacrifice. Revolutions, and our own included, require a certain amount of rationing, a certain amount of calluses, a certain amount of sacrifice, sacrificing one's old personal ideas about country, citizenship, work. And these people who have fled Cuba have not been able to adapt themselves to these new factors which have entered into their lives. These people are the uneducated. These people are the people who did not remain in Cuba to be educated by young people who were afraid of the alphabet, who are afraid of these new things which were occurring, who are afraid that they would lose something by collectivization. They were afraid that they would lose something by seeing their sugar crops taken away and in place of sugar crops, some other vegetable, some other product planted, because Cuba has always been a one-product country, more or less. These are people who have not been able to adapt.
Mr. Oswald, you say they're sugar crops. Most of the Cubans I've talked to that have that have had anything to do with agriculture in the last year and a half have not owned one single acre of ground. They were cane cutters.
That is correct.
And they're the ones that are fleeing the Castro regime.
That is correct, sir. That is very, very true, and I'm very glad you brought that point up. You know, it used to be that these people worked for the United Fruit Company. The American company is engaged in sugar refinery, oil refinery in Cuba. They worked a few months every year during the cane cutting or the sugar cutting, sugar refining season. They never owned anything, and they feel now that that little bit of right, the right to work for 5 months a year, has been taken away from them. They feel that now they have to work all year round to plant new crops, to make a new economy. And so they feel that they have been robbed. They feel that they have been robbed of the right to do as they please because of the fact that the government now depends upon its people to build its economy, to industrialize itself. So they figure they have been robbed. What they do not realize is that they have been robbed of the right to be exploited, robbed of the right to be cheated, robbed of the right of New Orleanian companies to take away what was rightfully theirs. Of course, they have to share now. Everybody gets an equal portion. This is collectivization. And this is very hard on some people. Some people prefer the dog-eat-dog economy.
What do you refer to as a dog-eat-dog economy? Is that capitalism in your definition?
No, that is an economy where the people do not depend upon each other. They have no feelings of nationality. They have no feelings of culture. They have no feelings of any ties whatsoever on a high level. It is every man for himself. That is what I refer to by dog-eat-dog.
Are you familiar with the existence of a black market in Soviet Russia or in Red China? Whereas the majority of the populace get their food, their truck crops, their vegetables, and such from this market. Do you know of such a market?
I know about the fact that there is a market in the Soviet Union only for Western apparel, Western apparel and certain other items. There is no black market in the Soviet Union for food, none whatsoever. By a black market, I assume that you mean a situation where food is either stolen or grown in one area and then taken to another area and sold covertly, undercover. No such system exists in Russia.
Mr. Oswald, I'm curious about your personal background. If you could tell us something about where you came from, your education, and your career to date, we'd be interested.
I'd be very happy to. I was born in New Orleans in 1939. For a short length of time during my childhood, I lived in Texas and in New York. During my junior high school days, I attended Beauregard Junior High School. I attended that school for 2 years. Then I went to Warren Eastern High School, and I attended that school for over a year. Then my family and I moved to Texas, where we have many relatives, and I continued my schooling there. Then I entered the United States Marine Corps in 1956. I spent 3 years in the United States Marine Corps, starting out as a private, working my way up through the ranks to the position of buck sergeant. And I served honorably, having been discharged. Then I went back to work in Texas and have recently arrived in New Orleans with my family, with my wife and my child.
What particular event in your life made you decide that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee had the correct answers about Cuban-U.S. relations?
Well, of course, Americans in general have only begun to notice Cuba since the Cuban Revolution. That is very true, I think. I became acquainted with it at about the same time as everybody else, in 1960, beginning of 1960. I always felt that the Cubans were being pushed into to the Soviet bloc by American policy. I still feel that way. Our policy, if it had been handled differently, and many others much more informed than I have said the same thing, if that situation had been handled differently, we would not have the big problem of Castro's Cuba now, the big international political problem. Although I feel that it's a jest and a right development, we could be on much friendlier relations with the government of the United States. Particularly certain covert undercover agencies like the now defunct CIA.
And now defunct?
Its leadership is now defunct. Alan Dulles is now defunct. I believe that without all that meddling, with a little bit different humanitarian handling of the situation, Cuba would not be the problem it is today.
Is there any particular act of the U.S. government, do you feel, that pushed Castro into Soviet arms?
Well, as I say, Castro's Cuba, even after the revolution, was still a one-crop economy, basing its economy on sugar. When we slashed the Cuban sugar quota, of course, we cut their throat. They had to turn to some other country. They had to turn to some other hemisphere in which to sell this one product. They did so, and they have sold it to Russia. And because of that, the price of Russian sugar is now down quite a bit, whereas ours is going up and up and up. And I believe that was the big factor, the cutting of the sugar quota.
Do you think that the U.S. government under President Eisenhower ever wanted to help the Castro regime, ever offered any sort of help to it?
True to our democratic policies, certain people, certain persons in the government, and certain policies adopted very late, but adopted by the government, helped Fidel Castro while he was still in the mountains. That is very true. We cut off aid to Batista just before the revolution, just before it. That was too late. We had already done more harm than we could have ever done before. We were just rats leaving a sinking ship, you see. That was not the thing to do. We have, however, as I say, helped him. We have not now cut off all that help.
There's one point of view which I've heard to the effect that Castro turned left because he could not get any aid for industrialization in Cuba from the United States. Does the Fair Play for Cuba Committee believe that?
Not entirely, no. We feel that was a factor, certainly. But we feel that the current of the history of the world is now running to that extreme. In other words, countries emerging from colonial domination and so forth are definitely adopting socialistic, leftist, Marxist, and even in some case what will be in the future communist regimes and communist inclinations. You see, this is something which is apparently a world trend.
Does the Fair Play for Cuba Committee believe that this trend should also be copied in the United States?
No, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee is occupied only with the Cuban problem. I don't think that they feel that way, no.
Thank you very much, Mr. Oswald. Tonight we've been talking with Lee Oswald, the secretary of the New Orleans chapter of the Pro-Castro Fair Play for Cuban Committee.
A prominent New Orleanian speaks from his personal recollections, Dr. Alton Ochsner, famed surgeon, past president of the American Cancer Society, and president of INCA. Dr. Ochsner.
When I was informed of the contents of this recording, I encouraged Ed Butler to go ahead and debate Oswald, because I firmly believe communist lies must be answered with truth. Some have said that if an INCA office had existed in Dallas, President Kennedy could have been saved. No one can be sure of that, but we can be certain that Oswald was exposed, discredited, and hastily departed New Orleans. We also know that by killing President Kennedy, Oswald diverted attention from Cuba and helped to prolong Castro's power.
Another distinguished New Orleanian who was deeply influenced by this tape was the Honorable Hale Boggs, congressman from Louisiana, House Majority Whip, Warren Commission member, and associate of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. Boggs remembers.
Just a few hours after President Kennedy's death, I sat with Ed Butler in my office in the Capitol and listened to this recording. What I heard was one of the things which prompted me to suggest and support the formation of a bipartisan presidential commission to investigate the assassination. I later served on that commission. I believe this recording is a most significant historical document.
Thank you, Congressman Boggs. Every time I remember Oswald, who idolized Castro, and someone asks me why he did what he did, I cannot forget these words spoken by President Kennedy to the Cuban Invasion Brigade upon their release from Castro's prisons.
Your conduct and valor are proof that although Castro and his fellow dictators may rule nations, they do not rule people. That they may imprison bodies, but they do not imprison spirits. That they may destroy, that they may destroy the exercise of liberty, but they cannot eliminate the determination to be free. And by helping to free you, the United States has been given the opportunity to demonstrate once again that all men who fight for freedom are our brothers and shall be until your country and others are free.